My topic is authority. It's been something that I've been thinking about for a while. But as I got going, I found that authority is a topic that's pretty difficult to research and investigate. And in fact, I almost wish that I hadn't decided to talk about it today, because it was pretty challenging. However, I believe as Christians trying to live righteous lives, it's an absolutely critical concept to understand. The authority that I intend to explore today is that which involves the power of an individual to exercise control over a situation and others. And what makes this difficult to examine is the fact that there are no real objective measures of an ability to exercise control. You can't pull out an authority meter and to get a reading of how much of it you may have or how much you may need. In addition, the causes and effects of authority are also so varied that it's difficult to find meaningful patterns. In fact, you can find contradictory ones. Instead, it seems that one must somehow perceive how much authority someone might have. By individually performing our own subjective tests, each one of us submit to authority that we determine worthy. And if we're looking for a system for figuring out how to determine authority, it seems that this is almost the best measure of what we have to work with. However, we all know that authority is much more real than that. All around you, individuals somehow manage to garner for themselves a following of people unanimously under the influence of their leadership. These are just natural leaders. And this means, to me, at some level, that there is some widespread agreement regarding the authority that somebody might have. So at one level, authority is subjectively determined according to fairly inconsistent and very personal criteria. And at another level, authority of certain people is undeniable. There's a big difference between the President of the United States and a Boy Scout, which is nearly self-evident. Now, thinking about the fact that some have authority that is more self-evident, while others may be in a position of authority, yet seem to have no exercisable authority, is what got me interested in this topic. I have questions about how this authority stuff works. How do you know if someone has authority? How can you gain authority? What are the differences between true authority and false authority? These are the questions that I found intriguing. They also happen to be the questions that confounded me once I started looking for answers. And unfortunately, I won't be able to answer them directly today, but I'm going to try to at least shed some light on this topic and show you what the Bible says about it. And what I intend to do is take a look at some of the teachings and examples of situations in the Bible to help us better understand authority, where it comes from, and how to respond to it. Jesus Christ is the quintessential example of authority among men in the Bible. And I'll start in Matthew 28 and in verses 16 through 18, where his authority is explained. Matthew 28, starting in verse 16. Then the 11 disciples went away into Galilee to the mountain which Jesus had appointed for them. When they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. And Jesus came and spoke to them, saying, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth." And that's where I'll stop. This is quite a claim, right? But notice what Christ doesn't say here, which could have had an equivalent meaning. He could have said, "I have all authority." He doesn't say that, though. What he does say is that all authority has been given to me. He acknowledges his place and the responsibility involved in being in a position of authority. He also makes a point to give credit to whom his authority came from, and that is God. Continuing in John 14, I'll read verses 10 through 12, which expand upon this concept a little bit more. John 14, starting in verse 10. "Do you not believe that I am in the Father and the Father in me? The words that I speak to you, I do not speak on my own authority, but the Father who dwells in me does the works. Believe me that I am in the Father and the Father in me, or else believe me for the works themselves. Most assuredly, I say to you, he who believes in me, the works that I do, he will do also, and greater works than these he will do, because I go to my Father. Now, the first thing that we can learn about authority from the example of Jesus is that it comes from God, and it is something that is given from God. It's a pretty foundational concept that is at the establishment of authority. Now, I'll read a little bit more about this in John 5, verses 25 through 30. John 5, starting in verse 25. Most assuredly, I say to you, the hour is coming, and now is, when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. For as the Father has life in himself, so he has granted the Son to have life in himself, and has given him authority to execute judgment also. So again, we see that authority has been given to Jesus, because he is the Son of Man. In verse 28, do not marvel at this, for the hour is coming in which all who are in the graves will hear his voice and come forth, those who have done good to the resurrection of life, and those who have done evil to the resurrection of condemnation. In verse 30, once again, I can of myself do nothing. As I hear, I judge, and my judgment is righteous, because I do not seek my own, but the will of the Father who sent me. And here is another very important concept. Christ again establishes that he's not exercising his authority of himself, but saying that he can of himself do nothing. But he's also saying that he's not seeking his own will. He has a will. We all have our own will. And a measure of authority is not self-seeking, but seeking the authority that does come from God. Now, Christ certainly had authority. It's undoubtable to us as Christians. You can read the Bible and understand that. Now, one of the things that got me started in wanting to explore this concept and a little bit more about the nature of authority was a passage in the Bible where his authority is somewhat, enlightened. His authority is not enlightened, but people perceive his authority by the way he talks. And the passage I'm specifically talking about is in Matthew 7. And I'll read verses 28 through 29. Matthew 7, starting in verse 28. And this happens just at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, when people are responding to what he said. Matthew 7, verse 28, and so it was, when Jesus had ended these sayings, the people were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority, not as the scribes. And that's where I'll stop. This example exposes some interesting things about authority. Here, Jesus is just at the beginning of his ministry, and he's teaching in a manner of authority that can be discerned merely by his speech. That's just crazy when you think about it. And people are acknowledging that immediately. Thinking about that for a moment, Jesus' authority was apparent merely by what he was saying and how he was saying it. Now, if we look back at some of the things that Christ was speaking about, you can start in Matthew 5 and look down. I won't go into it, but if you look and understand the principles of what he's talking about, he's expounding upon God's law in a way that has not been done before. And we heard a little bit about that in a sermon last week. He was teaching a deeper understanding of God's laws. And in one of the things he does, he condemns a certain kind of self-exaltation, which the scribes tended to do. And that is why I perceive that the scribes were, in Matthew 29, described as not having as much speaking as in as much authority as Jesus was. But Christ, rather, teaches how to live righteously in the sight of God rather than men, and he does so in a way that is not self-seeking. Now, what was it that made his speech somehow more authoritative? Well, foremost, he had qualifications. He had an astounding level of understanding when it came to the scriptures and the teachings of God. And Luke 2, Jesus is about 12 years old, and he is having a conversation with some of the others in the temple. Matthew 2, verse 42, and I'll read through 49. Luke 2, 42. And when he was 12 years old, they went up to Jerusalem according to the custom of the feast. And this is talking about Jesus and his parents at Passover. When they had finished the days, as they returned, the boy Jesus lingered behind in Jerusalem. And Joseph and his mother did not know it, but supposed him to have been in the company. They went a day's journey and sought him among their relatives and acquaintances. So he's lost, right? Where could he be? So when they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem seeking him. Now so it was that after 3 days they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the teachers, both listening to them and asking them questions. And verse 47, and all who heard him were astonished at his understanding and answers. So when they saw him, they were amazed, and his mother said to him, Son, why have you done this to us? And I'll stop right there. But the point is, he had an astonishing understanding of the scriptures, so that when it came to the point where he was starting his ministry, he was able to expound upon the laws of God in a way that was new and certainly authoritative. Now, we can imagine that he was probably saying some of the same things that he was saying in the Sermon on the Mount, and that when he entered the scene here, that age 12, he was teaching in a way that was fair, clear, and true, the way we know his teachings to be now. And this is how the people around him discerned his authority. He had great knowledge. Now, just because Jesus had authority doesn't mean that everybody followed his lead, right? They wouldn't have authority if there was no dissension. And there were challenges to his authority. This probably had to do with the fact that those in positions of authority felt very threatened by the true authority that Jesus Christ exemplified. Indeed, it seems that part of having true authority involves that it may be challenged. And one of the examples of Jesus' authority being challenged is in Matthew 21, and I'll start in verse 23. Matthew 21, starting in verse 23. Now when he came into the temple, the chief priests and the elders of the people confronted him as he was teaching and said, By what authority are you doing these things? And who gave you this authority? So they're definitely putting him on the spot. But Jesus answered and said to them, I also will ask you one thing, which if you tell me, I likewise will tell you by what authority I do these things. And I'll explain this a little bit after I finish these scriptures. In verse 25, the baptism of John. Where is it from? From heaven or from men? And they reasoned among themselves, saying, If we say from heaven, he will say to us, Why then did you not believe him? But if we say from men, we fear the multitude, for all count John as a prophet. So they answered Jesus and said, We don't know. And he said to them, Neither will I tell you. By what authority I do these things. Now, if you look closely at what's happening here, the Pharisees are trying to catch Jesus in a catch-22. If he says, I do this authority by the authority of men, they would say, well, you can't be teaching the things you are under the authority of men. These are the things of God. And if, on the other hand, he says, my authority comes from God, they would have said, that's blasphemy. You can't say that sort of thing. So Jesus turns right back to them and gets them in a catch-22. And of course, we know that Jesus's authority comes from God. So He handled that challenge of his authority quite well. Now, from these examples of his authority, we can take away a couple of points. The first thing that we can take away is that authority is something that is given, not something that is taken. And in his case, authority comes directly from God. Authority is also something that's not self-seeking. And these are two tests that we may apply to find out if someone is in a has true authority. Another fantastic example of authority in the Bible is the example of family. I'm very grateful to have my dad here today because he's certainly a great example to me of that. And this provides us with the model that we live with each and every day. Authority comes with responsibility to care for those in our care. So I'll read just a few scriptures about family here. I'll start in Ephesians, and I'll read starting in chapter 6, verses 1 through 9. Ephesians 6, starting in verse 1. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with you and you may live long on the earth. And you fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonish of the Lord. So here we have a principle, pretty concise. As children, we are supposed to obey our parents because it is the first commandment that we have from the Old Testament, one with promise. It says, as I just read, that we may live long in the earth if we do so. So there's a blessing associated with that as well. There's another point here that I want to bring up. And as parents, as a parent myself, I'm very aware of this, that there is a second half. In being a parent, we have to, as it says here, not provoke them to wrath. We have to honor our position of authority as parents so that our children may see us as respectable. And that means acknowledging our personal authorities that are above us and living in a righteous way. Authority involves leading with love, and there are responsibilities for that. As parents, we have to care for those that are under our care. And there are other roles within a family. Husbands and wives, right? So I'll read probably the most popular scripture, Colossians 3, starting in verse 18 and reading through 21. Colossians 3, starting in verse 18 here. Wives, submit to your husbands as it is fitting in the Lord. Husbands, love your wives and do not be bitter toward them. Children, obey your parents in all things, for this is well and pleasing to the Lord. Fathers, do not provoke your children, lest they become discouraged. We have the same principles here. There is a hierarchy within a family, but there's love involved. Authority is not just wielding power. Authority is responsibility, primarily, and this example of a family is where we see that. As a leader within a household, as a parent, especially, and husbands and wives, there is responsibility involved to love those who are under our care. I'll read 2 Timothy as well, chapter 3, verses 1 through 9. 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1 through 9. But know this, that in the last days perilous times will come. For men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of God, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. And I'll stop right there, I suppose. Now we can see that those who are disobedient to parents are grouped together with some other really despicable folks. And these people won't meet a pleasant end. So it's very important that we obey the authorities within our family. Our roles within our family are part of our lives and every day. It is both critical and commanded that we honor our position and responsibilities, and of course honor our parents. From the example of family, that we can see that it is important that authority be respected. Yet it is only respectable when that authority is exercised in a responsible and loving manner. Authority is about serving, not being served. And the scriptures here I've read about family are part of that. But I want to read another one in Mark chapter 10, verses 42 through 45. Mark chapter 10, starting in verse 42 here. But Jesus called them to himself and said to them, "You know that those who are considered rulers over the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you, but whoever desires to become great, but whoever desires to become great among you shall be your servant. And whoever of you desires to be first shall be slave of all." Verse 45, "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." Once again, we have an example of serving as an essential part of authority. Jesus Christ himself had tremendous authority because he was willing to sacrifice his entire life for the sake of others, those who are within his care. It is the act of serving that is a critical element in a position of authority. On the other side of the coin, taking a higher position for yourself is not rewarded. And this is one of the elements pointed out here in Mark 10, 42 through 45. One of the greatest examples of somebody serving others and a rise to authority because of that serving is the example of Joseph. And we heard a little bit about this last week, but I'll go over a few scriptures that I don't think we went over. This is in Genesis 41. I'll read verses 37 through 44. Genesis 41, starting in verse 37. And this happens just directly after Joseph has interpreted one of Pharaoh's dreams, and Pharaoh elevates him to a point of authority. Genesis 41:37. "So the advice was good in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of all his servants." So this happens just after the interpretation of the dream. And this happens also just directly after Joseph had spent 2 years in jail. He had been waiting there, and this was a tremendous opportunity. So you can just imagine. He goes from, imagine yourself being in jail. You've just interpreted the Pharaoh's dream, and this is what happens. Verse 38, "And Pharaoh said to his servants, 'Can we find such a one as this, a man in whom is the Spirit of God?' Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, 'Inasmuch as God has shown you all this, there is no one as discerning and wise as you. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you.' And Pharaoh said to Joseph, 'See, I have set you over all the land of Egypt.' Then Pharaoh took his signet ring off his hand and put it on Joseph's hand, and he clothed him in garments of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. And he had him ride in the second chariot which he had, and they cried out before him, 'Bow to the knee.' And so he set him over all the land of Egypt." So he's gone from a prisoner to controlling the land of Egypt. That's just amazing. Now, let's see. Verse 44, "Pharaoh also said to Joseph, 'I am Pharaoh, and without your consent, no man may lift his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt.'" And I'll have you skip down to verse 47. "Now, in the 7 plentiful years, the ground brought forth abundantly. So he gathered up all the food of the 7 years which were in the land of Egypt, and laid up the food in the cities. He laid up in every city the food of the fields which surrounded them. Joseph gathered very much grain, as the sand of the sea, until he stopped counting, for it was immeasurable. Now, the point I wanted to bring out here is that Joseph was in a tremendous position of authority. He'd gone from rags to riches in a big hurry. He had control of the entire nation of Egypt, and all those in the country were subject to him. He could have done anything he wanted. However, what did he choose to do to honor his position and treat it with responsibility? He organized the people so that they would be able to save in the time of abundance, so that they might be saved in the time of drought and difficulty. In doing this, he served, he held his position in a very responsible way, helping the country make it through some seriously tough times. So it's critical to understand that part of having an authority is being responsible and caring for others that are within our care. Now, I could be a little bit off base here, but I find that it's a pretty easy thing to take these concepts that I'm talking about and apply them only to the spiritual facets and parts of our lives. Said another way, I find that it's pretty easy to throw these principles out the window when it comes to when we come in contact with and work with others who might not be playing with the same rules we are. We understand authority, and when we work with other people who don't understand authority in the same way we do, it becomes pretty difficult to respect others in that situation. However, the Bible teaches us that even though others may not understand what the Bible teaches about authority, we still need to obey the authority when we are subject to it. And the Bible backs this up. And I'll have you turn to Ephesians chapter 6, and I'll read verses 5 through 9. Ephesians 6, starting in verse 5. Bondservants, be obedient to those who are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling and sincerity of heart as to Christ, not with eye service as men pleasers, don't just look busy, but as bond servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, with good will doing service as to the Lord and not to men, knowing that whatever good anyone does, he will receive the same from the Lord, whether he is slave or free. And you, masters, do the same things to them, giving up threatening, knowing that your own master also is in heaven, and there is no partiality with him. Here we're told that, plain and simply, we need to be obedient as workers and employees, because ultimately we're working for God. The caveat, of course, is that we need to work according to God's will and not contrary to it. Likewise, when in a position of leadership, we need to treat those that are in our care without threatening and domination. We need to treat them well, with respect and love. I'll expand a little bit more on this in 1 Peter. 1 Peter 2, verses 13 through 17. Starting in verse 13 of chapter 2. Therefore, submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme or to governors, as to those who are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of those who do good. And verse 15, for this is the will of God, that by doing good you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men, as free yet not using liberty as a cloak for vice, but as bond servants of God. Honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. So the same rules apply to our place underneath the government that we reside in. And I'll just read Romans 13, 1 through 4 for you, which says similar things. Romans 13, verse 1, let every soul be subject to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God, and those who resist will bring judgment upon themselves. So I'll stop right there. What's important to understand is that authority comes from God. He is the source, the ultimate source. And in fact, this may be the most important scripture that I cite today. Knowing that all true authority comes from God, we know that being obedient means being obedient to God. Also, when in a position of leadership, we have a tremendous responsibility to lead as God would have us lead. Authority comes with accountability. A message about authority and power just wouldn't be interesting if I didn't show a couple of examples of dissension and rebellion. If there's an example of an individual in an authoritative position in the Bible who had to manage a disobedient and rebellious lot, it was Moses. The people he was trying to help fulfill their destiny only seemed to complain and whine as they were led out of Egypt from terrible lives of slavery. You'd think that they might be a little grateful for being released from bondage, but no. Even Moses' own brother contributed to the frustration he had. I'll read a passage from Numbers 12 about Moses, Aaron, and Aaron's wife, Miriam. Numbers 12, I'll read verses 1 through 10. Just after I have a sip here. Numbers 12, starting in verse 1. Then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married. For he had married an Ethiopian woman. So they said, "Has the Lord indeed spoken through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also?" And the Lord heard it. Now the man Moses was very humble, more than all men who were on the face of the earth. Suddenly the Lord said to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, "Come out, you three, to the tabernacle of meeting." So the three came out. Then the Lord came down in the pillar of cloud and stood in the door of the tabernacle and called Aaron and Miriam, and they both went forward. Verse 6, then he said, "Hear now my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision. I speak to him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. I speak with him face to face, even plainly, and not in dark sayings. And he sees the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses?" So the anger of the Lord was aroused against them, and he departed. And when the cloud departed from the tabernacle, suddenly Miriam became leprous, as white as snow. Then Aaron turned toward Miriam, and there she was, a leper. Now, the reason why I brought out this example is to show how God responds to rebellion. Knowing that it all comes from him, he does not like it when authority is rejected. In this case, God backs up Moses completely, enforcing his authority. And that's another point to bring out. True authority is enforced, not forced. Rather than have to deal with the ones above Moses and in return be plagued with a bout of leprosy, Aaron and Miriam should have acknowledged their position in the chain of command and respected Moses' position and authority first. And perhaps an even greater example of rebellion than Moses happens, a little bit after. I'm missing my chapter here, but I believe it's Numbers 14. No. Thank you. Numbers 16. Or is it number 17? No, I'm kidding. Numbers 16, verses 1 through 5. Now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, with Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben, took men, and they rose up from before Moses with some of the children of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, representatives of the congregation, men of renown. They gathered together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, "You take too much upon yourselves, for all the congregation is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord?" So when Moses heard it, he fell on his face, and he spoke to Korah and all his company, saying, "Tomorrow morning the Lord will show who is his and who is holy, and will cause him to come near to him. That one whom he chooses, he will cause to come near to him." Here we see a problem, right? That we have envy, we've got power hunger. As I mentioned in the introduction, authority is something that we all put our own tests against in order to measure the authority of another, whether those measures are right or wrong, right? And in this case, Korah and his cohorts, they applied their own tests, those being that they themselves were holy as well. And they looked at Moses saying, "Why is he any better?" And in doing that, they felt that they could have as much authority as Moses. And that's just not true, right? Korah is, it certainly seems as though his motivations were wrong. As I've mentioned before, there's a whole lot of responsibility involved in having a position of authority. And the scriptures say that Moses was very humble. He was not leading in a self-seeking manner, but seeking the will of God. And what strikes me most about this example is the humility. When Moses is confronted with this dissenting throng, he falls on his face. We know from other examples that Moses certainly had a temper, but in this situation, he didn't let the anger get the best of him like we might imagine happening, for ourselves if we were there. Instead, he commits the problems completely into God's hands, confidently knowing that the situation will be managed. And I'll continue, give you the rest of the story here. Numbers 16, verses 28 through 33. "And Moses said, 'By this you shall know that the Lord has sent me to do all these works, for I have not done them of my own will.'" So he's not seeking his own will, he's seeking God's. "If these men die naturally like all men, or if they are visited by the common fate of all men, then the Lord has not sent me. But if the Lord creates a new thing, and the earth opens up its mouth and swallows them up with all that belongs to them, and they go down alive into the pit, then you will understand that these men have rejected the Lord.' Now it came to pass, as he finished speaking these words, that the ground split apart under them, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up, with their households and all the men with Korah, with all their goods. So they and those with them went down alive into the pit, the earth closed over them, and they perished from among the assembly." So here we have 250 people at least dying because they decide to rebel against the true authority that God has established. The point here, obey, right? A true and genuine authority, the kind that comes with the holographic sticker, if you will, is quite a delicate thing. To those whom it is given, there is a tremendous responsibility to care for those people being led. Not only that, but since authority originates from God, there's a tremendous accountability that comes with a role of authority. To honor that role of authority, the power that comes with it must be used wisely and for righteous means, and not self-seeking ones. So if that's what true authority looks like, what does false authority look like? And how should it be responded to? We're told that authority ultimately comes from God, whether it happens to be our parents, the ministry, or the government. We also know that it is something we need to submit to and obey. However, God gives us conditions under which it needs to be obeyed. When is it right to dissent from authority? I won't hold you in suspense. It is right and required, even, to reject authority when it goes against the will of God. When I think of an example of false authority within the Bible, one of the primary examples that comes out is the example of Haman and Mordecai. Haman treats his authority like it's a weapon, something to wield, something to dominate the people underneath him. And I'll have you turn to Esther 3, where I'll read some of this story. Esther 3, and I'll start in verse 1 and read through verse 10. Esther is right before Job, so if you're looking for it. Esther 3, verse 1. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. And all the king's servants who were within the gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. So here we have dissension of authority. Then the king's servants who were within the king's gates said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" Now, it happened, when they spoke to him daily, that he would not listen to them, that they told it to Haman to see whether Mordecai's words would stand. For Mordecai had told them that he was a Jew. So Mordecai is not bowing down to this authority figure because he didn't believe that it was correct. Let's see here. Let me just skipping some of the mundane details. Okay, so Haman didn't like it, basically. And in verse 8, Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all the other peoples, and they do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. If it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed, and they will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work to bring it to the king's treasuries." So here we see Haman, who didn't like being rejected, having his authority rejected, and he does something that's very self-seeking. It's deceptive and even harmful to those under his power. He tries to have these people wiped out and killed. That is certainly false authority. And I'll continue in Esther 5, reading verse 9 and then verse 14. So Haman went out that day joyful and with a glad heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and that he did not stand or tremble before him, he was filled with indignation against Mordecai. Then in verse 14, then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, "Let a gallows be made 50 cubits high. In the morning suggest to the king that Mordecai be hanged on it. Then go merrily with the king to the banquet." And the thing pleased Haman, so he had a gallows made. So again, we see Haman following through with his self-seeking plan to have Mordecai executed. He's taking his authority, and he's not acting in a responsible manner. And in doing this, I won't continue reading the story, but you should. It's fun and interesting. But Haman pays for his penalty by being hung himself on those gallows. So he's ultimately repaid for the lack of responsibility in his position of authority. Now, I think an even better example of when dissension is correct in positions of authority is within the example of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We're probably all familiar with this story. And King Nebuchadnezzar is certainly in a position of authority. And he had set up a proclamation that all people should bow down to him at a certain point in the day. Yet these three would not. So what he did was try to have them forced into doing it. So I'll have you turn to Daniel 3, and I'll start in verse 14. Daniel 3, starting in verse 14, Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up? Now if you are ready, at the time you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the harp, and the lyre, and psaltery, and symphony, with all kinds of music, and you fall down and worship the image which I have made, good. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If it is the case, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up." So here we have a correct dissension from authority. Let's see how it's responded to, or how what happens. In verse 19, then Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, and the expression on his face changed toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He spoke and commanded that they heat the furnace seven times more than it was usually heated. And he commanded certain mighty men of valor who were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the fiery furnace. And Daniel 3, verse 24 and 25, then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose in haste, saying to his counselors, "Did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king, look, I see four men loose walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God." So in this example, we see that in Nebuchadnezzar, in his position of authority over Babylon, when he requested that these three worship a god that was not the true god, that this dissension is in consistency with the will of God, and their lives are spared. So the story ends up well, but the point here is that if authority is not consistent with the will of God and the laws that he has set up, that is not a true authority. And let's see, I'll just tie things up here. Authority is certainly something that's tricky to understand. Putting your finger on it and saying that this is authority is not necessarily a difficult thing to do, but answering why an individual has authority is much more of a slippery task. Each one of us has the same body of flesh. We live on the same earth, and we construct ideas that we believe are right. And authority is the factor that elevates one individual's status above another. But how do you get it? And once you have it, how do you use it? When you're subject to it, how do you respond? Fortunately for us, the Bible has given us some answers to these questions. And to sum up in a sentence, true authority is that which is given by God to whom to those whom love the people they're responsible for, seeking the benefit of those in their care rather than their own will. And I'll wrap up here with a verse out of Proverbs. Proverbs 29, verse 2, "When the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. But when a wicked man rules, the people groan." And another one, which is the corollary. So this one I just cited is telling us that it's good to be righteous when you're in authority. Proverbs 30, verse 17, "The eye that mocks his father and scorns obedience to his mother, the ravens of the valley will pick it out, and the young eagles will eat it." So there are punishments for those who are disobedient. Authority applies to us all, both as subjects and as leaders. Whatever position we're in, let's make sure to honor the authority that's given to us as well as the authority over us.